Meeting of Senate Hess to order for today, January 28th. Recognize and welcome Senator Ellis, Senator Ward, Senator Green, myself, Senator Wilkin. Senator Cowdery is with us this morning to join us on one of his bills. Purpose of today's meeting is to discuss Senate Concurrent Resolution 19. We'll do that first. We have some folks on teleconference that have joined us. And then we'll move to, we'll bring back to the, for the committee's consideration, House Bill 189, Act Restricting Tobacco Sales. So, anything to come before the committee before we begin? Seeing none, let me recognize on the teleconference, Anchorage, Kotzebue, and Fairbanks are with us, and they'll keep us informed as you folks come into the LIOs for testimony, and we'll be to you here just shortly. And we'll begin testimony this morning by welcoming Senator Kelly, co-chair of the Deferred Maintenance Task Force, and he's going to present to us Senate Concurrent Resolution 19 regarding prototypical schools. Morning, Senator Kelly.
Morning, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, the Deferred Maintenance Task Force received testimony on the cost savings and operational advantages of prototypical schools. Several communities use them today. The task force found that savings in design cost and ease of maintaining several identical physical plants offered the opportunity to fund more schools as the savings are achieved. One rural school district has expressed great interest in using a prototypical for schools in its district. They are currently in discussion with the Fairbanks School District to learn from the Fairbanks experience. And we did see two schools in Fairbanks that used the same design. They basically turned the second one another direction, painted a different color, and duplicated the first one, and it was built, as I understand it, at less cost, and it is working very well in the Fairbanks area. The resolution requests the Department of Education to develop prototypical schools and incentives for districts to use them. The Department of Education is requested to report to the legislature by March 1 any statutory changes that may be needed to accomplish this goal. And that, in essence, is the resolution.
Thank you, Senator Kelly. Questions or comments? I might just comment that I was pleased to be a member of the Deferred Maintenance Task Force, and I'd had some prior experience through my association with the school district in Fairbanks of the of our prototype effort in Fairbanks, which had been about 10 years old. And when I traveled to some areas this summer, primarily an example would be Buckland or Kiana up in the Northwest District, I was struck by the idea that a prototypical school in those areas would be indeed a welcome addition to their villages, and it could be done for significantly less than perhaps what they were thinking. It had on the list, at least the list that we were presented with, that numbers just didn't jive. So to that, as I continued to travel around, the prototypical idea became more and more appealing. And the deferred maintenance folks, as we discussed it, thought more of it too. And if indeed we can take double-digit numbers out of the cost of building schools in all across our state, not only in Bush but also in the urban areas, we'll get more bang for the dollars. So, having said that, we're going to have some people this morning here in the room talk to us about prototypical effort. Senator Kelly, if you'd be good enough to join us, if you'd like. And we have on teleconference this morning, morning, Senator Lehman.
Good morning.
We have on teleconference this morning some folks to speak with us. And let's see, let me get lined up here. In Anchorage, we have Mr. Doug Green. Mr. Green, good morning. If you would please go ahead and testify on SCR 19 and state your name and whom you represent, if anyone, and please limit your testimony to 5 minutes, please. Good morning.
Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Doug Green, and I'm a member of the American Institute of Architects and the Alaska Professional Design Council. I'm also the chair of the Government Affairs Committee for the American Institute of Architects, and I'm a practicing architect here in Alaska. We have some concerns with the concept of using prototypical schools throughout the state of Alaska. because we have a large population and because we have similar site conditions that these schools can be reused on, and the same firms have been involved in reusing their design for these school facilities. And that works well and is probably the best application for a prototypical design. We have a concern when we start to talk about prototypicals across the state of Alaska. As you know, the state of Alaska has a wide variety of site conditions, climatic conditions, soils, and so forth, and there is very little saved when you consider the cost at each school site that have to go into the design of a school. You may save 15 to 20%, and if that, on utilizing a design, if all of the site conditions are similar. If you have a slope site in one situation and a flat in the other, you may not save anything. So we're concerned about the idea of just doing this across the state. We also have been in contact with the American Institute of Architects nationally, and we have received from them some information that I've forwarded on to the committee. But one point I'd like to make there is that in 1991, the Department of Education in Georgia surveyed 49 states with respect to the using of prototypical school design. And at that time, their findings were that many of the states would not do, that had tried prototypical designs would not go back and utilize them again, and that at the current, and at that time, there were no states that were using them on a statewide basis. There's a lot of cost that goes into developing various designs for different climatic and soil conditions across the state. These designs, once developed, start to age, and as soon as the code changes, as soon as new developments in technology occur, these designs are dated, and they will need to be updated, and that process is fairly expensive for the state on a long-term basis, whereas you achieve that in each new school design. The whole thrust of the committee is to save money and maintenance in these outlying areas. We have found that a village or a small school district where these members of the district and members of the community are involved in the design of a school, they take much greater responsibility for that building, and they treat that building better than one that would be just the standard state design that might get locked down for their use. And that pride of ownership and involvement translates to lower maintenance costs and better care for the facilities. We also have an issue with liability. As I mentioned, in Anchorage and Fairbanks, the opportunity for the same firm with that design exists. A firm that has designed a prototypical school can reuse that design and can put it on another location for the school district. When you produce prototypical designs to be used statewide, you end up with the problem of maybe one architect having to modify another one's design, which liability becomes a problem, and our insurance companies do not support very readily that type of activity. In addition, we think that there would be some difficulty in the standardization of ed specs throughout the state of Alaska. Currently, they are not standardized, and we think that there may be some problem in looking at that across the state. We would like to suggest that there could be some great headway made by introducing a database of typical things that have worked well for school districts across the state, that this might be available to a website or not gone well, so that the designs of the schools may be more standardized, but not made into a stock plan or a prototypical. I think that's our main thrust, is that we feel that there's maybe a little more thought that needs to go into this before the state of Alaska launches into a program of typical school design. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Green. Questions of the witness? Mr. Green, other than the issue of foundations, which, and of course, flat versus a sloping site, what would other major variables be for a basic school across the state?
We found that many of the variables have to do with the climate. If your building is southeast, there are quite a few different concerns with the heavy rainfall, the moisture in the air, and so forth, that you do not find up along the north coast, along the west coast of Alaska, where the concern there mainly is for fine powder, driven snow, infiltration, vapor barrier concerns, insulation, and the like. What you might end up with is an over-designed model for southeast and an under-designed model for areas along the north coast. You also have areas that have very high winds. Some of the coastal areas, even in Anchorage, are over 100-mile-an-hour wind design, whereas other areas of the state don't experience that. The variety of those types of things tend to dictate how you detail a school and how much time and effort you spend on it.
So, and I should clarify too that I think we're only speaking of second primary schools, K through six, and not junior highs or high schools. So perhaps we could then have three prototypical schools that would be climatized, for the want of a better word, north of the Arctic, north of the Alaska Range, south central, and southeast. That may take care of some of the climate issues.
Well, I think that there may have to be three or four. The other, you've got the climate, and then you've also got seismic zones that differ throughout the state. And a lot of money can be spent structurally for a zone four-based building as opposed to a zone two or lower zone in the center of the state.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Green. Any other comments? Thanks for coming out this morning. I'd like to go to Fairbanks. Mr. Mackler, are you online?
Yes, sir, I am.
Good morning, Mr. Mackler. Mr. Mackler came to the Deferred Maintenance Task Force in Fairbanks, gave testimony in both verbal and visual, and then gave us a tour of two prototypical schools. And he's here this morning on teleconference to essentially repeat what he told the Deferred Maintenance Task Force. If you would, please, sir, go ahead and begin your presentation.
I'll just try to take you quickly through some oversight of what we do in Fairbanks with our prototype. We use a 600-student elementary school prototype, the first one we built in 1983. We wrote the contract then so that we owned the design, and since then we've built six more of them. Sort of fairly spaced well out over that time. We've improved the design each time to correct any facility or educational program problems that have arisen out of the previous versions. Our prototype requires a fairly flat site, but we also have a hilly site prototype design that we've only used one time. We've never had another hilly site, so we've never had to do a second one of the hilly site designs. The last of the seven prototypes we built and occupied this last summer cost $9.9 million for construction costs, and that's construction cost only, of a 63,000-square-foot building, so it's $157 a square foot. The The advantages and benefits what we've realized in Fairbanks are, one, the time savings. It takes us a year less in design phase because we don't need to do a full building design. We only have to do a complete site design, and we have to update the building design from the previous one with the latest things that we need. This saves us a year of inflation in costs. It gets our kids into better facilities quicker, and it reduces our overcrowding quicker. We also have a quicker response to voter bond issues, which is a plus for our voters. They don't see years and years before anything happens. Number two, we have a pretty good savings in money. Just in the design fees alone, we're spending about 5% of the construction costs on our prototypes for the A&E designs versus the more typical about 10 to 11% of a completely new design. We have under design right now a comparably sized building for a middle school, and it is costing us 11% in A&E fees. The difference of that 6% is about $750,000. And of course, there's the one-year inflation savings I mentioned above. The third item that's an advantage is the competitiveness in the bids. Contractors that bid on these all know that the previous low bidder on every one of the previous prototypes made money, so everybody really gets fine on their bids. They typically hire foremen that have worked on the jobs before for other contractors when they get the job, and they hire subs who have worked on the jobs before. Every one of our projects at bid phase has come in under the engineer's estimate, and in many cases fairly significantly. And I can't say that for new designs or renovations and additions that we have done or others have done. The contractors like to do these schools because they know that the drawings and the design are very, very complete. Very few change orders or problems found during the construction. Fourth advantage is our educational program needs are well met. These are schools. We've got to educate in them, and so that's the most important item. The teachers and the principals love the design, and they know that they have significant input into it. At the end of the first year of occupation of a new one, we do a full post-occupancy survey. Everyone in the school, from the day custodian, the mechanics, the nurses, the teachers, the parents, the principals, are asked the question, if you had to do over again, what would you do differently? All of those comments are reviewed and written up and analyzed and then go into improving the next design of the next one. During the design phase, the teachers, the schools, and the kids and the parents that are going to be going into that school are consulted and pick the colors inside and out, pick the school name and the mascot. We upgrade the technology each time in the design to bring it up to the current standards. And we put one district-wide special ed program in one of the rooms, and so we custom design that room to meet that program's needs. Fifth advantage we have found is in the first year or in the first couple of years, startup problems are drastically reduced. I think most of us know that have dealt with new buildings and new designs. When you go into it for the first year, it looks wonderful and new, but you typically have lots of startup problems. Heating doesn't work right, it overheats, it overcools, things don't work properly, the intercom systems don't work, and you have lots of problems the first year in what should be a wonderful experience. A lot of times it becomes rather frustrating for the teachers. And because the building's under one-year warranty, you get into a lot of finger-pointing, and in fact, there's usually more finger-pointing between the owner and the builder and the architect than there is wrenches turning to fix it. We've found with a prototype, with a proven design, the proven systems, and the proven components, it works very well from day one. We still have a few problems, but they usually isolated to one system and usually minimal. This means we've got happier teachers and kids in the schools. The sixth item that we like is the standardization of systems and components, which we believe reaps us big rewards in overall maintenance programs, both in routine and major maintenance in the future. High-quality components really help. We also use the prototypical design or the elements of it in renovations and additions to older schools. They don't have to look exactly alike, but we use a lot of the features. In summary, our school and our community like the prototypical concept and the use of it. Our teachers and our principals like it. We believe it saved us considerable money in initial construction and in long-term maintenance of our facilities. So we're for it in this community, and we've enjoyed the benefits of it.
Thank you, Mr. Mackler. Questions of the witness. Mr. Mackler, when this process started, who speaks against the effort in Fairbanks for prototypical schools? Who have been ones that have been detractors?
The only concerted effort we had against it was some of the people in the design community, particularly unsuccessful architects who weren't getting, who were being beaten out by the original architect who knew the most about the building. The request for proposals phase of hiring an architect for each one. We had a couple of architects come to the school board at about the third building and argue that it wasn't serving the community well, that we needed to be coming up with new designs, and the school board, based on the savings of cost and the year design and the input from the teachers and the staff and the happiness with the staff of the building, decided that that had no merit, and they went ahead and continued with the prototype.
Okay. And thank you. Senator Lehman?
Mr. Mackler, in your school district, who assumes the liability for the designs when they are upgraded? You talked about technology upgrades and some of those things that you do. I assume that somebody is making those changes. Do you have an agreement with the original engineers and architect, or are you assuming that responsibility as a school district? Do you have your own professional staff?
Our borough has public works staff, and they are the ones that contract for the construction. The school district is the user of the building, and we're a fairly aggressive user. And the borough, it takes our input. The borough owns the design of the school, and so each time it's upgraded, we own that design. And so I guess you could assume that the borough has some liability for the design. But when we do ask for proposals from architects, we do still continue to get more than just the an architect that's been doing all of these for us.
Well, I'm not sure you totally followed my question, but you came around to it. When you say the borough has some responsibility for design, if you are making changes to that design, you have full responsibility for that design. And I guess then my question is, who is stamping those contract documents?
The architects are stamping those contract documents.
Okay. And which architects? You have architects under contract to the school district?
We for each time we get ready to build one of these prototypes, we go out an RFP to hire an architect, and then that architect is the architect responsible for that design to the borough, and they're the ones that stamp the drawings.
They take the prototype design that you have, make some changes as appropriate for that site, and incorporate any technology changes that you may want based on staff input from the previous project. And those architects and their, I assume, subcontracted engineers seal those contract documents. That's the procedure you use?
Yes.
Other questions? Thank you, Mr. Mackler, for coming and testifying this morning. We appreciate it, and I would also mention to the committee that Mr. Mackler is a member of the Bond Reimbursement Committee, which will visit this issue in February here in Juneau on the 19th. So thank you for being here this morning. Let's move to Kotzebue, and there's two folks there, Mr. Lou Matheson and Mr. David Bell. Let's start with Mr. Matheson. Good morning, Lou. If you would, please, your testimony.
Good morning, Senator and members of the committee. My name is Lou Matheson, and I am the superintendent of Northwest Arctic Borough School District. Certainly appreciate the opportunity of being able to participate in this conference this morning. In addition to what Mr. Mackler said, Northwest Arctic Borough School District is going to be in favor of prototypical schools.
construction background in my previous life before getting into education and administration. We do believe that it does have some merit even in rural Alaska and even in different building sites. But there are three issues that I would like to bring up. One, Mr. Mackler has already brought up, and I do believe it will bring about an initial reduction in construction costs, primarily due to design costs, that we should be able to eliminate. I also believe it will bring about a reduction in operation costs due to standardization of equipment and materials that will be used. We also anticipate that there will be a reduction in expansion costs. Our villages are constantly expanding. We have schools that were built and finished, one right here in Kotzebue that was completed in 89, I believe, that is already well beyond its capacity. So we're going to have to be looking at things for that. So when we're looking at expansion, if we can get a prototypical that can be expanded upon very easily and not have to do a complete redesign and rebuild, I do believe that some cost savings could be made there. As I said initially, we're in support of the concept, and we will certainly be willing to assist the committee in any way that we can to expedite severely what we consider to be severely needed new construction in rural Alaska. And with that, I'm going to close, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Matheson. Questions or comments? Thanks for coming out. And I would just mention, I think the Buckland School is number 7 on the capital replacement list. So it's near the top. That's for the committee's information. Thank you, Mr. Matheson. Mr. Bell, are you there in Kotzebue?
Yes, Senator, I am. I believe Mr. Matheson covered the remarks I was going to make.
All right. Thank you. Any questions of Mr. Bell? Thank you both for joining us this morning. We're going to go to the hearing room now, and we have Mike Morgan from Department of Education. Mr. Morgan, morning. You would please tell us what you know.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Michael Morgan. I'm the facilities manager for the Department of Education. On the issue in this resolution, the department prepared some statements for the committee that went over some of the challenges that will need to be met. But I think that the things that we really need in order to accomplish this task is in the way of more definition. The resolution talks about developing prototypes for core school functions, and it's not immediately clear what that is. Mr. Chairman, you mentioned earlier in discussions that this is really looking at a prototype design for elementaries, and that wasn't in the resolution. So clarification on whether it's going to also include K-12 construction would be helpful as we look at this issue. One of the other factors in looking at prototypical designs, which wasn't mentioned this morning, was the issue of size. And certainly there are varying size requirements as we look at rural Alaska and the state, running from the paper we presented, we postulated 4 different size ranges, which gives a scope which allows for expandability, which has been mentioned by several people. And then the last caution that I might mention is that we have a history in the state of having used a stock plan at one point in time. That was in the 70s. And so if we go ahead and develop prototypical designs, I guess I'd want to assure in that process that we didn't have the same problems that we're experiencing now with those plans reoccur.
Thank you, Mike. Questions or comments from Mr. Morgan? Mike, were the Molly Hooch schools prototype or cookie cutter schools?
They were. Most of them were. There were a great number built off of the same plan.
I think Senator Lehman and myself had a chance to see some of those schools, and they're, I guess, disappointing at best.
If you saw the ones where they had a narrow stairway going up into an attic type, it's not even a boiler room, forced air furnace room. Oh, yeah. Those were the plans that were replicated in a number of places around the state. And it's a design that suffers in a number of aspects, both just from a maintainability viewpoint and a usability viewpoint. One of the things, I went to a conference this summer held by the Council of Educational Facility Planners, and one of the things that was presented at that conference was the experience that British Columbia is having in their schools. They have kind of a wide climatic range, as Alaska does, ranging from the very temperate area in the Okanagan to Arctic conditions in the north. They have some Indian areas, so they have small schools. And they have some things that they've done that are similar to what we do, in that they have space guidelines for people to follow for sizing their schools. But some things that they've done to control costs are they put a limit on the per square foot cost with an adjustment for area. And then they also require value engineering, which says if you're going to use a component in a school, you need to have gone through a process that says over the full life of that school, that makes economic sense. And a good example is some schools get specified with cedar siding, which we all know looks great. But if you're not getting out and coating it with a sealer every 3 to 5 years, it's not going to hold up. And so we're going to have problems like we have in some schools in the state right now with deteriorating exterior skins that have migrated into the structural members and actually allowed them to rot.
Well, you know, this may be the worst idea ever to come down the pike, but you and I are going, and the committee, or the Bond Reimbursement Committee, are going to work this with the help of some deferred maintenance task force money. So we're going to press on, and this will be the last this group hears from this for a while. But I think experience will tell us at least it's worth exploring, and this is a good time to do it. And if we can save 10 or 15% on every school, we can get down that list a lot faster to please everybody. So, we're going to need your help to do that. I know you can do it. Johnny, Senator Ellis?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Were you suggesting some of those things that British Columbia has used as an alternative to what the resolution calls for, you all developing regulations and incentives for using prototypes in Alaska?
I guess the reason I brought that up is I think that what the issue of prototypes, what that brings to the table is that there are a lot of things that could be done to control costs. And certainly as we look at this issue and explore through the use, I think all of those aspects that could be used to control costs should be looked at. And so I offered those up as other possible avenues that could be used either instead of or in conjunction with the use of a prototypical design.
And I'm looking here for, and I know I have it, but one of the charges of the Bond Reimbursement Committee that this legislature put together in 1994, which I have here, that I don't know if it's in your packet or not, is it? Is to analyze existing prototypical designs and for school construction projects. So back in, whenever this was done, actually 1993, there was some thought of to sort of wrestling with this idea. And we had already started this long before the Deferred Maintenance Task Force had come along. My first meeting, in fact, in August, they had a report on it. So, I mean, the ball is starting to roll, and we're going to sort of pick this up and chew on it here in a few of our meetings and see what we can do, because that's what we're supposed to be doing. Senator Ellis?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Has BOE compiled, or have any of the professional associations compiled anecdotes or any kind of statistical information about the experience with the Molly Hoot schools or other schools? You mentioned we used a prototypical approach in some parts of the state in the 70s and have had a lot of problems. Has that been documented?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ellis, that's not been documented. It's on the department's list to do what was suggested by Mr. Green in his testimony, which is to have a lessons learned. I think that all of us with background in the construction industry in this state, as we went through the 70s and 80s, found firms that came in from outside, did a job, left, and we learned painfully things that didn't work, and at the same time, things that do work. And it's on our list of things to do is to compile that information, but with our staff and the other charges we haven't been able to do that yet.
With my limited visits to the bush this summer, I would just offer Senator Ellis that the Molly Hooch Schools offered an opportunity to task the maintenance of any school district. And those that took that task seriously and did it, and I'll say Golovin, for instance, have a school that's adequate today and maintained. Those that didn't, for whatever reason, they have a school that wasn't helping them. The school was maintenance heavy to start with. And you can tell. I mean, they're not built. Those schools were not built for Alaska. That's from a potato chip dealer standpoint, I thought. So, anything else to come before the committee? Senator Ellis?
Mr. Chairman, I wanted to ask if Mr. Green is still on the line, if we couldn't, I didn't see it in my packet, his testimony in writing, if we don't, the committee doesn't, is it in there?
And also, and I could, we're going to hold this bill today. We have a position paper coming from Society of Architects.
Okay.
That's going to be here. Also, we're going to change a little bit to address the case six issue and work on a few other little wording parts. But at least we have it now out on the table, and we'll bring it back. Senator Lehman?
Mr. Chairman, I can reserve some of my comments for next time, but I think it would be worth saying a few things now as, you know, if we're working on it. I served on a different maintenance task force with you, visited a number of these schools, and over the years, I've probably been in many of these schools around the state. I've probably been involved with the design of some, if I maybe think about it, but none of the bad ones. But I have some reservations. Mr. Green expressed many of my reservations. I'm a professional engineer, and I've been involved in a lot of this work. I have some reservations with thinking we can apply a simplistic solution to, you know, across the state to solve the problem. What we're trying to do is to get good answers, good designs for a lower cost, and I agree with doing that. I also agree that we have had some success with this in Anchorage, especially recently, and I'm very pleased to hear the success in Fairbanks. The other areas that have used them, I'd like to hear from them to see what their success is, and I would be in favor of encouraging this where it can be successful. But I don't want us to get our hopes up too high that this might be the solution that solves it for us across the state, because there's a whole bunch that goes into why schools fail or why something doesn't work as well as we'd like. I think there are some good ideas like outline specs or something like that, where we lay out essentially what needs to go into a building and the systems in the building, the mechanical, electrical systems, the things that typically go wrong. There are ways to do that I think can be guidelines to school districts, and I see nothing wrong with taking designs that work well, like the ones in Fairbanks, and having that reside in the DOE, for example, in a repository, and so people can see, yes, these are reactions. But I would be awfully reluctant to request the DOE to develop prototypical designs and say, okay, you go out and contract and tell somebody to create these designs, and then have these as off-the-shelf designs that school districts then are supposed to take and do what Fairbanks has done. I think that going that far would be a mistake. I don't think that having some standardized types saying that this is what we've learned, and having some of your staff, or perhaps if you're not able to do it, somebody on contract to you to identify what's been bad in terms of all sorts of things and what's good, I think that is a very good idea. so we can share it. And chances are we'll find the societies across the state willing to participate in that and contribute that time and maybe even hold workshops, of people who are willing to get together and do that. So I think that's good, and we should be able to learn from the past, both our mistakes and the good things. But anyway, Mr. Chairman, I guess in summary, I like what you're trying to accomplish, and I think it's with the right spirit, but I think some of the things in the resolution probably can be dangerous, and I would like to work with you and others to see if we can craft this to encourage that type of activity that will accomplish good without stepping over and getting into an area where we may be getting ourselves in trouble.
And I think those are good words, Senator. And I don't, what we're trying to do is here is offer a concept for the legislature and the administration to work towards. So we don't want to get too bogged down in the details here yet, because we'll have a lot of work to do on the bond reimbursement committee. But your words are well spoken. Anything else for Mr. Morgan or for anyone else regarding SCR 19? Seeing none, thank you for being here. And those on teleconference, thank you for testifying on SCR 19. We will bring this up for those on teleconference. We'll bring this up again at the Bond Reimbursement Committee meeting, assuming it passes legislature on February 19th, I think is its tentative date. Senator Ellis.
If I misunderstood you, I thought you were going to do some work and bring this back before the committee.
Oh, we are. Yeah. That's right. You're right. We're going to work on the language. We've got some things.
Oh, okay.
So we will
it comes back before the committee.
Right. Thank you for clarifying that. We'll see it again with the changes. And we also have some more testimony from the architects. Okay. Let's move now to, let's move to House Bill 189, having to do with restricting tobacco sales. And we had this in front of us last week. Representative Calvary, the bill sponsor, is with us today with his staff, Marco Pinalberry. And let's just start with you, Representative Calvary. Where are we today?
We had talked last week about some maybe necessary changes in it. And we've developed and worked with the people, and I'd like to have Marco explain some of the concepts that we've been working on.
Mr. Pinalberry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, we've distributed this morning a copy of the new draft CS, which has in red ink five numbers.
Let me interrupt just a moment. Chair would entertain a motion. Is it version L?
That's correct.
Chair would entertain a motion to consider a Senate CS for CS for SS for House Bill 189, version L, as a working document. Senator Ward?
So moved.
Thank you, and I won't say that again. Any objection?
I wasn't going to try.
Objection? Hearing none. Please, Mr. Pinalberry.
Thank you. There are five key changes that were recommended by the committee and by the Attorney General's office since our last meeting, and so I've just made marks on the draft that you have five numbers, and I'll go through each of those five changes with you. First, on page one, where you see number one in a circle there in the red circle, we've changed the culpability standard from knowingly back to negligently, so it's really back the way it is in existing statute. And this is in concurrence with our feelings that the committee expressed in working with Senator Lehman in the past week to do this. And that change is carried out in every section of the bill. On page number two, down around line 12 and 13, you'll see new language that says basically an employee break room or controlled area of a private workplace not generally considered a public place, and the room or area contains a posted warning sign at least 11 inches by 14 inches indicating that possession of tobacco by a person under 19 years of age is prohibited under the statute. This applies to break rooms, for example, like in a store like Fred Meyer's, where they may have minors under 19 working at night or any time, and there's a vending machine selling cigarettes in there. We didn't want to ban a vending machine selling cigarettes altogether from all kinds of businesses, so with the help of Senator Ellis and his office, we came up with the concept of posting a sign that simply reminds people on that premise that you have to be 19 years of age or older to use a vending machine. Down at the bottom of page 2, you'll see number 3 there. The lines 29 through 31, this is merely a clarifying phrase that says that if you're in the wholesale business and you decide to sell retail, then you must adhere to the self-service ban that we have for retail sales. There was some confusion by several people who read the bill, and it came up in committee last time, that what happens if a place like Costco or some other place is a wholesaler and they do retail. This simply makes it clear that if you're going to have a retail transaction, then the prohibition on self-service displays adheres. And then at the top of the next page, lines 1 and 2, where you see that number 4 there, this is new language, and as I mentioned to the committee at the last meeting on this bill, the municipality of Anchorage had adopted a provision substantially similar to House Bill 189, but they're working on an amendment to cover cases for tobacco shops in Anchorage, and it might be the only place in the state we have five or half a dozen shops that sell only retail products. And after the ordinance in Anchorage was enacted, some of the owners came forward and said, well, you know, technically, if more than one person comes in the store and we don't really control them, they have access to our products, our only product is tobacco, we're concerned that we would be in violation. And so this is the amendment that it's based on a Texas statute. This is the language that was suggested to us by a member of the Anchorage Assembly who's sponsoring that legislation. And it simply says that if a place is restricts access to people who are over 19, and you can't be in there if you're under 19, then the self-service display ban doesn't apply. Now, Mr. Hickey will testify later on that he'd like to see this language tightened up even further. I've looked at his language, and we've discussed it with the Attorney General's office, and he'll recommend some clarifying language that we have no problem with when he testifies. And then finally, the last change since you saw the bill last is Section 6 of the bill on the bottom of the last page. And this simply ties the penalty provision to the occupational licensing statute. It was not clear to the Attorney General's office that the penalties could be invoked against people who had licenses under the occupational licensing statute. So this makes it clear that the penalties would apply. You see, the only new language there is the reference to 1176-100, and it includes that as the penalty applying to the occupational licenses. And those are the changes, Mr. Chairman.
Questions of the staff? Senator Lehman?
Mr. Chairman, Marco, there's one other change that is significant that you did not highlight, but that is Section 3, which is the middle of page 2, where you drop the approach of making this a Class B misdemeanor, and you kept the language of staying with a violation.
I'm sorry, that's correct. We went to the violation with a $300 fine. fine, not less than $300
fine. Which is existing law.
That's correct.
Existing law. Okay. I just want to make sure that...
And there was one other change. There's a deletion. The last section of the bill, as you last saw it, had a sentence in it that said, should this bill and House Bill 159 both be enacted during the 20th legislature, they shall be given maximum effect. And we said that would not be necessary because we're putting the vending machine statutes back into this bill. So that was deleted. So that's a change, but of no consequence.
I do have a follow-up question. The current law and the law stated in this bill will say that the violation shall be punishable by a fine of not less than $300. I assume that is indeed what the penalty has been the few times that this has been imposed. What is our maximum limit on the dollar fine for a violation? Is it...
Although I heard the testimony here last time that it could be as high as $1,000.
$1,000, okay.
But I would ask you, when is Ms. Carpinetti here? Yeah, when the Attorney General's office testifies, I think you should ask that of them.
Okay. I still think that $300 probably will change behavior, especially for a store clerk. And I'm more interested in changing behavior than I am particularly in the amount of the fine or whether somebody gets a misdemeanor. But I think that this will change behavior, especially if judgment is swift and sure. So I appreciate your considering that, and I think that's the correct way to go.
Just have one
Senator
question.
Green?
Yeah, I wasn't here when we had the other discussion on it. And could you review for me the difference in negligently and knowingly?
Yes. The culpability standard for negligently applies to a violation. There's a lower standard of culpability. When you... increase the fine, and again, the AG's office could probably testify to this more comprehensively. When you increase the penalty or the fine, the law requires that you increase the standard of culpability. The burden of proof on the state becomes heavier, more difficult to achieve. So that is the reason why, because the law enforcement officials who testified at the last hearing, that is how they wanted to go back to the lower penalty because it would have a lower burden of proof that would be more easy to achieve in the course of a prosecution. Did I answer your question, Senator?
Yeah. Yeah.
The hammer's too heavy to lift is
yeah,
what the problem was. And you changed it to the lower. Other questions? Thank you. Mr. Pugnalberia, online we have one person in Anchorage, and we'll go to the teleconference network and welcome Ms. Anne-Marie Holden. Ms. Holden, good morning, if you would please, your testimony.
Yes, good morning, Chairman Wilson, members of the committee. My name is Anne-Marie Holden. I'm with the Alaska Native Health Board and also with Citizens to Protect Kids from Tobacco. I wanted to express our appreciation to the committee for taking to heart some of the suggestions that were made at the last hearing. For this bill, I think we have a much stronger bill in the work draft that I'm looking at here this morning. I actually just had a couple of questions that I was hoping to be able to direct to someone from the Department of Law, and I don't know if there's anyone there at the hearing.
Yes, there is, and Ms. Carpinetti is here, and if you'd mind joining us, please. Stand by just a minute, Ms. Holden.
Okay.
We have joining us at the table Ms. Annie Carpinetti from the Department of Law. Go ahead, Ms. Holden.
Okay,
Holden.
Thank you. My questions have to do with how this legislation would be enforced in the real world, and a couple of questions. One is, how would the police determine if a vendor is violating the provision that all sales must be clerk-assisted? Specifically, I'm wondering if a police officer can simply look in the store and cite a merchant if the officer sees self-service tobacco displays, or whether they would have to witness a purchase attempt to be able to cite the merchant. That's one question. And the second question is in regard to the exemption.
Let's, Ms. Holland,
stand by just a moment.
Okay.
Any response to that?
Well, I would prefer to have a Department of Public Safety person answer that question. It's my understanding that the purpose of this bill is to avoid having to have sting operations to enforce the tobacco statutes, and that's why there's a requirement that they be controlled sales behind a counter. My point, what I wanted to express to the committee, which I've already discussed with the sponsor this morning, is that the section that does that, I think, could be drafted a little bit more clearly to make it a little bit more understandable.
Okay, let's come back to that and let sure. Ms. Holland continue. All right, Ms. Holland, your second question, please.
Okay, that's in regard to the exemption for retailers who restrict access to persons who are 19 or older. I'm wondering how it would be determined that they qualify for the exemption and how it would be determined if they are in violation. Specifically, I'm wondering if a merchant could hide behind a defense that, well, they do restrict access because they have a sign on their door that says you have to be 19 or older to enter the premises, or whether they could be cited if a police officer observes a teenager, you know, entering the store and walking around without being challenged for ID.
Mr. Chairman, that's the issue that we were discussing this morning, and it was suggested that subsection B of the new proposed section 1176-106 be amended so that, or redrafted so that it was clear that this exception applies only to retailers who sell mainly tobacco products and not the 7-Eleven stores that have cigarettes there too. So I think that is that could be problematic, and it could be something that also could be easily repaired.
Ms. Holland, I think Ms. Carpinetti is going to address your concerns when she gives her testimony. And you're, of course, welcome to stand by and listen to that. Please continue.
That's all I had with those two questions.
Okay. Thank you. Questions of Ms. Holland? See none. We have two people that would like to testify, Ms. Carpinetti and also Mr. Hickey, but while you're at the table, why don't you just go ahead and give your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to thank you for the amendments that you made that were suggested by my boss a couple weeks ago. And the only suggestion that we have now is that 1176 in Section 4 on page 2 of the work draft would, I think, be a lot clearer if it were rewritten more in a positive rather than in terms of negatives. And there's a second problem with this section. It doesn't have a penalty provision, which you need. So that needs to be added. And then also, Mr. Hickey raised the same issue that the previous witness raised, is the problem of a retailer. If you don't restrict it to retailers that only sell tobacco products, you're applying an exemption to all retailers, and you might have a loophole that would provide a defense to prosecution. So we've talked to the sponsor this morning, and these things could be easily repaired, and we'd be happy to help redraft them in a way that they're more straightforward and clear.
Representative Cowdery, do you see any major problems?
We discussed that very early this morning. Office had been working on it, and we apologize for not having the language exactly the way we was, but it's coming, believe me. Like somebody said, it's none of the things that we do is perfect, but we want to try to make them as near perfect as we can for later.
And that's our job as the Yes Committee, to do those things. So we'll do them.
Near perfection.
Near perfection. We don't want to do everything right, because those folks down the line, then we won't need them and they'll feel badly. So. But we're going to work on it. So then we'll come back then next week with a committee substitute, and we're going to hear from Mr. Hickey here in just a second. Any questions of Ms. Carpinetti?
I just have a comment.
Senator Luna?
Annie, your son and his teammates delivered a lesson in life to my son and his teammates last Saturday, and I guess to the extent you can thank people for those lessons, I thank you. You've raised a very fine young man and a very fine basketball player.
Well, thank you very much.
You didn't have to do quite so good a job.
You have to talk to his father.
And enjoying it so much.
We try not to, Mr. Hickey, if you would, we try not to divert our subject off of what we're trying to do here. But in the case of basketball,
yeah,
it's
basketball.
All right.
It's an error.
Youth recreation should be.
Youth recreation is all right, and I would rise from my chair.
Midnight basketball.
I would rise from my chair to talk about that. So, Mr. Hickey, good morning.
Chairman, I would add he has a beautiful jump shot. Chairman, for the record, I'm Mark Hickey. I'm also representing the same group as Anne Marie Holen, Coalition of Citizens to Protect Kids from Tobacco. And very quickly echo the same comments that you've already heard. We applaud the work of the committee and the sponsor to bring the bill forward and to make the adjustments. The only item I was going to testify to, you've already heard, and that is this question on page 3 with the new subsection B under lines 1 and 2. There's some concern that the way it's drafted might not get us exactly where we want to go, and that enforcement actions could be negatively affected. Our suggestion, which we've gone over with the sponsor, and I believe we have his support, would be to add a lead-in to Section B that would simply say, in the case of a retailer that principally sells only tobacco products, then you would have, this section does not apply if they limit access to adults, to individuals 19 years of age or older. And the drafter may come up with something a little more artful, and we'll provide that to them. But that would make it clear that the intent is that in those cases, they would not have to, if they restrict access and they're a tobacco smoke shop, they would not have to have self-service display bans. They would not have to comply with the controlled access. And I think that's going to address the one enforcement concern that we had with the language. Otherwise, we're very supportive of what we have in the CS.
Yep. Thank you. Questions of Mr. Hickey? Senator Lehman?
And you said principally sells only. I think you can drop probably the only. I'm thinking of there's a little shop right by the cars, Aurora Village Cars, near where I turn to go home, and it's, I don't know, the Great Alaska Tobacco Company, whatever it's called. And I think it's those types of places that you're probably looking at, and I assume that's principally what they sell in there. But there may also be a few other things that I don't know what they might be.
Senator Lehman, I would agree. We started with language that was sells only, and our concern was that might be too limiting. So principally sells.
There may be pipe cleaners and things like that sold in there, which arguably are not tobacco products.
So. Other comments or questions?
Thank you.
Representative Cowdery, anything?
No, we will come back with clean bill with all everything that we talked about, hopefully next week.
We'll just wait for you, and maybe Friday or Monday, but yeah. we're at your call.
We can do it. Finally, I'm sure.
Okay. Anything else to come before the committee this morning? Seeing none, we're adjourned. Thank you for coming.